open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
And he takes one look at me and I could just see it on his face. He's saying to himself, what in the hell is the newspaper doing sending this damn hippie down here to interview me?
Welcome to the National Writer Series on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Author Beth Macy says it wasn't hard to get former Bassett Furniture factory workers to talk about their old bosses.
And like Downton Abbey, the people on the bottom, the servants, the line workers, they know all about the people at the top. So you can imagine, now the factories have all closed, I show up, they're dying to tell me about the people at the top. They're dying to tell me everything.
Factory Man is Beth Macy's first book. It's the story of American furniture maker John Bassett III and his struggle to keep his furniture company in business in the face of increasing competition from abroad. Macy's latest book is Truvine, Two Brothers, a Kidnapping, and a Mother's Quest, a true story of the Jim Crow South. It's about two albino African-American boys who were kidnapped in Virginia and forced to work in the circus as sideshow curiosities. Beth Macy talks this hour with fellow author and journalist John U. Bacon. She told him that even though it happened over 100 years ago, the story of the two boys hasn't been forgotten.
If you go to Roanoke today and you talk to anyone over, say, the age of 60, who's African-American, they would have grown up hearing the story about the Mews brothers, and they would have been told, like when they went out to the circus or a festival, they would have been told, now y'all stick together or you might get kidnapped like George and Willie. So the story that the family had always passed down was that around the turn of the last century, their George and Willie were young boys and they were out sharecropping. Their family was a sharecropping family in Southern Virginia, on a tobacco farm, and a bounty hunter for the circus came by and kidnapped them. And that was the last their mother saw. Nobody lifted a finger to help her get them back until 1927 when they came through and she found them. And we know that part's true. There was about a quarter of the way through the research, I ran into some evidence that suggested that perhaps she had initially let them go, possibly for pay, we don't know. But the evidence is also, it's questionable. Mm-hmm. And it's an uncomfortable thing to bring up. It's a painful thing. Nobody in the family today wants to hear that. But regardless, we know that she wasn't expecting them to be gone for 13 years. And so I just tried to show these two stories in the full context of what it would have been like mm-hmm. for the family and what it may have been like for her wrestling with this decision.
There are heroes and villains in the story, no question about it, but nobody is all good or all bad pretty much from the start, including the complications of the story itself. We're not quite sure about that. The managers, Candy Shelton is one of them certainly that makes our list. There's some good guys and some bad guys, and most of the bad guys are in the early going.
In the what?
Early going.
Yeah.
Candy Shelton, for example, the manager.
Yes.
Ringling Brothers, mixed bag perhaps, but certainly not noble, I would say. I was also surprised to learn, and pick up any one of these threads, but I was surprised to learn that freaks in the circus actually were kind of arrogant towards others.
Yeah.
I was not expecting that. That was a juicy little surprise.
They had a pride of calling, and Willie would say, always, he would say, they were laughing at us, but we were laughing at them because they were paying money to see us.
We're all laughing, we have your money. So that's the difference there. Talk to us about the handlers, of course, when they're out of their mom's range. They're now at the mercy of the managers, the agents, if you will. People like this, they meet along the way. And some of them are pretty bad guys, and Candy Shelton makes that list.
Yeah. So he's the one that Willie said kidnapped him. This is another reason that I think we can't just dismiss his version of the story. He named his kidnapper. He was the only one that they ever said anything that Willie and George ever said anything bad about. We have written documentation that they were sold from one carnival operator to another, mm-hmm. to a bigger one, then to the circus. The picture of them with their, that I showed you earlier with the circus manager in between them, he bragged about buying them and selling them, really wrote about them in loan shark terminology in his memoir. I mean, he bragged about it. So, I mean, that is the challenge of this book was really trying to bring to life this world in which it was just a given if you were a white person you thought African Americans were subhuman beings. And that was raw stuff to wrestle.
And of course, with that came the right to do with them whatever you wanted.
Yes.
Was the idea.
Yes.
So.
Of course, you wouldn't mistreat somebody you're going to exhibit. You wouldn't mistreat them so bad because they still had to be exhibited.
Out of self-interest.
Yeah.
Right. Other good stuff, of course, the heroes come along. If the whole story is pretty amazing to us, I'm also struck, and you mentioned, of course, the police chief who founded the KKK in their town actually took their side in this, took the mom's side, Harriet's side in this. Some others have come through along the way, including the lawsuit that you mentioned that she won. Yeah. Help came from unexpected places.
Yeah. And it's really interesting. So she files a lawsuit. She wins a settlement for their back wages in 1928. The brothers on their own decide to go back with the circus. We have to remember that this is kind of what they grew up with. It was the life they were used to. I'm sure there was a little Stockholm syndrome involved. Mm-hmm. But regardless, whenever the circus could get away with not paying them, they thought, well, what's Harriet Muse going to do if we're in Washington State or Vancouver? What's she going to do? So when the check stopped coming home, she got another lawyer to basically set up a guardianship that put into place a legal system wherein anytime the checks didn't come home or they bounced, there was a process in place that to go track them down. Often they would hire Pinkerton detectives or missing persons detectives, and they would find them wherever they were in the world, and they would make them pay. And that was a great mystery to unravel, just to like, how did they do that? And a lot of what I did was I was looking at articles and clippings and court documents. I mean, the court documents were a trope, but some of the best stuff I got that sort of brought the court documents to life was I would drive around this neighborhood where the family lived in with really elderly folks who had either a connection to the family, had met them, knew them well, a few were relatives, and they would bring to life these little details that I didn't quite fully understand in the context. And it's something I've always known as a reporter, but I keep relearning it. Like, nothing beats like going out and talking to people.
Stomping the pavement and getting out there.
Absolutely. And one of the things I love to do is just drive people around, because it's like it prompts people in their memory when they see places that they haven't seen in a while. It just reminds people of stories. Sometimes I have them show me old photo albums, but in this case, there weren't a lot of old photo albums. This is a really impoverished neighborhood. It's still the poorest neighborhood in the city where I live. And there just weren't pictures, but these mostly older ladies just brought this era to life. And they remembered things like, one of the most moving things anyone told me, really just not so much about the Muse brothers, but about what life was like for their family back at home in Jim Crow, Virginia. And I was driving around with a woman in her mid-80s, and she remembered that when the brothers would come home in the off-season, Candy Shelton would hover over them. And she just looked at me, real plain-spoken. She said, well, because the circus owned them, you see. And we were driving around, and she was talking about how in Roanoke, Virginia in the 19-teens, the city actually made ordinances of where whites could live and where blacks could live, and they couldn't live on the same blocks. But those blocks could also be like butting up against each other. So she remembered walking to school, and because they didn't have a bus for the black children, and they had to walk pretty far and to cross a bridge and go into the black school. But she remembered as she walked past this one house. Now, the house doesn't exist, but we're driving around, and I'm recording her with her permission on my iPhone. She remembers, she sees this grassy lot, and she said, oh, that's where so-and-so lived. And it was a Victorian white house, and she kept a pair of parrots on the side porch. Mm-hmm. And the parrots would squawk, see them little N-words coming as the children would walk past on their ways to school. I mean, just, and that's the kind of memories that these older folks are still carrying around 80 years later.
I've got a bunch of questions, but I've got to derail myself as usual. How did you get all these people to trust you?
Well, I've been there for a long time. And that's a great place about reporting. The great thing about reporting from the same place is I could get sent out on almost any story, like when the Virginia Tech shootings happened. And I wouldn't necessarily know someone there, but I always know someone who knows someone, right? So I could always have a little entree. And with this story, the newspaper's first black newspaper reporter is a woman named Joanne Poindexter, and she grew up in that neighborhood. She's now retired and in her late 60s. And she goes to this church, Jerusalem Baptist Church, that is kind of the community center of the neighborhood. And she basically introduced me to all these ladies that I drove around with. Some of the people in the book I knew from previous stories. There was a 98-year-old gentleman with a wonderful memory named Alphonse Holland, and he was 10 years old when Harriet got them back from the circus, and he remembered it like it was yesterday. He was like the prodigal kids coming home, and he remembered like hundreds of people from all quadrants of the city converged in their tiny little front yard to get a peek at them. And I met him from a story I had done years earlier. So, you know, just that's the great thing about reporting from the same place is you really get to know people. And when I came along in journalism, and probably you too, there was a great emphasis in making up for the sins of our predecessors in the business. So
we were not popular then either, is what you're saying. So. It's only gotten worse. It started out badly, and then it's gotten worse since then. So, yes. But we are not bitter in any way. So.
Yeah, yeah. So, but we were trying to make amends for things like my newspaper didn't run black bridal announcements until the mid-70s, and only after people staged a big protest in front of the newspaper building. We editorially cheered when the city tore down 1,600 African-American homes and churches. And so when I came along, and probably when you came up too, there was this great emphasis on hiring black reporters and black editors and doing more stories, not just stories when black people got in trouble. And so a lot of my contacts in that community grew out of that that ethos of trying to write about all zip codes, not just the people like me, so that if Roanoke has a 25% African-American population, which it does, then 25% of my sources should be African-American. And one of the ways I got these great sources was I hung out at places like the Goody Shop once she let me stay.
Obviously, Harriet Muse was a force of nature. As an illiterate sharecropper who somehow gets attorneys to take on Ringling Brothers and others, she's pretty amazing. She had to overcome a lot of obstacles. One of them was her second husband. Mm-hmm. Of course, tell us about him and how she ultimately got around that.
Yeah, so she wins this sizable settlement, and I didn't really know what happened with it, but we wrote a story about the Muse brothers after Willie died in 2001 in the newspaper. So Nancy did let us do that, but she didn't tell us much. And one of the things she didn't tell us was how Cabell Muse met his demise, which was he was caught sleeping with another man's wife, and he was brutally murdered. He was stabbed like 12 times or something.
For which the man served about 2 years, I believe, so.
One or two, yeah. Not much at all.
Clearly the jury is not that sympathetic with the victim, so.
Yeah, yeah. And so Cabell was a bad guy. But so she's the one that, she finally tipped us off after the newspaper story ran, and she goes, "Well, you missed a big one, Scoop." I mean, so this is what I'm dealing with, like, for 25 years.
That one,
like,
you just have to take that one, don't you?
Yeah, you do. And then if you ask a question that she perceives as being kind of nosy, she'll go, "All right, Snoop." So some days I was Scoop, other days I was Snoop.
Well, there you have it. On the lighter side, these guys were phenomenal musicians.
Yeah.
And they also managed to travel to Hawaii, Venezuela, Mexico, Canada, and the UK. And the UK was an interesting story also.
Yeah, yeah. They went over there during the off-season in 1928. They rode that ship that I saw a replica of in Halifax. Mm-hmm. You should talk about Halifax.
We'll get to
He's
that.
Doing a book that I wanted to do. We just found that out today.
Yes.
Arm wrestling will commence afterwards. We're taking bets.
Stick around. It's going to be good.
But they went to England, and they performed there in the off-season.
But the English attitude towards them was very different than they encountered elsewhere.
Right, right. They thought they were to be pitied, and they shouldn't be exhibited. They really thought they were mentally inferior, which they were often portrayed as, but they weren't. And one of the reasons that I interviewed people, some people thought that sideshows weren't as popular in Britain is because they had a much higher rate of injuries, PTSD after World War I. Mm-hmm. And so there were like a lot of people with deformities and disabilities because of the war, and they were just more sensitive.
And therefore, it's not funny.
Yeah.
So the music, though, these guys were clearly not imbeciles. They were not educated. They were not literate. But they were clearly not stupid, and their music ability, I think, is one chunk of evidence for that. And they're phenomenal musicians.
Yeah, it was said they could hear a song one time and play it on almost any instrument. And that one picture I showed you from 1917, when I showed that picture to Nancy, she said, Willie said the first time they were handed instruments, it was thought to be a joke. They wanted to get a picture of it and sell it as a little souvenir postcard. But they thought, they can't play. And of course, they ended up being great musicians. And it was, we all, when we get to do what we love to do, it makes us happy. And I think that was a real comfort to them, especially in the early years when they told their mother was dead. And so even at the very end of his life, he's still singing songs from the 19-teens and 20s that remind him of his mother. And he's still, I have a picture in the book of the guitar he played with the fretboard worn down. He played it so much. And then when he had a stroke at the age of 102, he couldn't play it anymore, so he held it in his lap and he sang the songs.
He could play more than the guitar. They played almost any instrument immediately.
Yeah.
Give us a little rundown.
One of the songs that they played early, it was a World War I anthem about missing home called It's a Long Way to Tipperary. And that was a really special song, and he would sing that later in his life even. And I have a recording of it. I didn't bring it with me today, but it's very sweet. And you could hear like his the notes dipping, and you could just tell it's a song he sang thousands of times. But he would sing that song at the end of his life, and he would talk about his mother, and he kept a little portrait of her right next to his bed. And even though he was totally blind by the end of his life, he would straighten the picture every night, and he would say, "Our mother came for us. She could have been arrested. She could have been killed."
Both true.
Yes, yes.
That's a very powerful story, to say the least. It does end, I would say, given the final contract that they had and the fact that their mother put the house in their name, what could have been a disastrous end for these guys was, I guess, better than expected.
Yeah. So her second legal maneuver results in basically them having a house bought and paid for by the time they retire in the early 60s. And so Nancy had told me early on, when she gave me permission to write the book, I had asked her in November of 2013, she made me wait 6 weeks before she called me back with her answer. I was not to call her. I sent her a Christmas card. P.S. My phone number is. And she called me back on Christmas morning.
That's a hell of a reporter right there.
Just in case you've lost it.
That's right. Merry Christmas also.
She called on Christmas morning. She said, I made you wait so I could give it to you as a gift. I know you're going to find out some sad things. I know you're going to find out some raw things. But no matter what you find out, I just want you to remember that in the end, they came out on top. And I think once you understand their story from their point of view and from others' point of view, you really see that compared to Candy Shelton, who doesn't
the
end up so good,
agent, right?
They really lived. They went from being a cautionary tale, don't go out or you'll get kidnapped, to wise elders in the community, and they were very well taken care of by mostly the women in their family.
Very cool. We're going to shift gears now to her other book. Here on this table. Until the third one comes out, we'll talk about that before we're done also. True Vine, I think you'll find it right outside in the lobby. It makes a great gift.
Yeah, we don't want to give too much away. We want them to buy this book.
just get the book, trust me on that one. How's that for an easy sales pitch? Factory Man. And by the way, I also need to thank my wife, Christy, who's here in the audience tonight. She did a great job helping me. She reads faster than I do. We both read the books, of course, but she reads them better than I do, and the dumb questions are mine and the smart ones are hers, just so you know.
Thank you, Christy.
It's pretty consistent, actually. Factory Man, of course, this is near and dear to your heart, given your background. Even though you're from rural Ohio, you'll fit in very well in Southern Virginia, and this is one of the examples of this. Also a hard story to tell with very stubborn underdogs who succeeded against considerable odds.
Right.
Give us a bit of background.
Yeah. So I was just back from my Nieman Fellowship, and the last furniture factory in Southern Virginia closed. It was called Stanley Furniture. And my editor wanted me to go do, she was going to give me a lot of time, which is kind of rare these days, go do a series about what happens to a community when half of its jobs go away. And literally, first the textile plants closed, then the furniture plants closed. And this was one community that was heavily invested in those, just those two things. And so not only did the factories close, but also the little mom and pop diners where the factory members, workers would eat. And by the time you tallied it all up, literally half the jobs had gone away. We had had the highest unemployment rate in the state for over a decade. This is about an hour south of where I live, in Henry County, Martinsville, and Bassett, Virginia, which is the home of Bassett Furniture. So I thought, I'm going to go, I got to figure out how to do this like sad story, and also what does happen? Like disability rates go up, crime rates go up. I mean, there's all these things. I didn't know how I was going to tell the story. And so I said, well, who do I know that knows a lot about furniture? Because that had been most recently shut down. And so I took my, I didn't go very far, so it's not really that great a story. I went to my neighbor's house. He owns a furniture store. And I said, tell me about the furniture industry. And so we're talking over breakfast one day, and he's basically giving me economics 101. He's a total free trader. I mean, he just thinks like, yeah, we're going to make a lot of money. And you know, the irony is like, I wrote the book proposal in a chair that he sold me at the family discount, made in China, right? But during the process of his little economic lecture, and you know, creative destruction, and it's just, you know, it's gotta be that, you know, people shouldn't be making furniture in America anymore. He says, well, you know, there is this one guy who still makes furniture in America, bedroom furniture, in Galax, Virginia. And not only that, in order to still be doing it, he actually sued China in a court of international trade to prove that they were illegally dumping product in our market to get us to go out of business. And that's illegal according to the WTO rules that China signed on to when they joined the WTO in 2001.
World Trade Organization, obviously.
So he files this lawsuit from tiny Galax, Virginia, which is a town better known for bluegrass and barbecue, the largest anti-dumping petition in the world against China. And so Joel, my friend, is telling me about this, and I was like, whoa, I didn't even hear about that. It was really just reported in the trade press. So a little bit, like I think the New York Times and Wall Street Journal had done one little story, but we didn't, that was 2 hours away in the other direction, and we didn't know about it. So I said, oh, what's this guy like? I mean, I knew he was a Bassett, so I knew the family story would be interesting.
Right, the company starts in 1902. And John Bassett III is obviously third generation, and that's pretty rare in itself in American business. He had to fight two enemies, one the Chinese, the second one his brother-in-law.
His family.
Which is also a great story.
He was born to inherit this business, and before he comes back from the military after college, his older, very cunning brother-in-law, brilliant, is like fixing to elbow him out, and he does eventually. But so I had said to Joel, so that was a great story, and he told me about the family feud, and I had said to Joel, well, so what's he like? I always want to know, like, are they a good talker, right? And he goes, oh, he says things like, the effing Chi-coms aren't going to tell me how to make furniture. And I thought, oh my God, who says that? I got to go meet this guy. So I called his son, who like handles his marketing and PR, right, you know, such that it was. And he said, sure, come on down. Dress down. You'll be in and out of the factory. We're out of the factory. And so I went in my jeans and my hiking boots, and I had my hair pulled back in a ponytail. And he finally walks in, and he takes one look at me, and I could just see it on his face. He said, he's saying to himself, what in the hell is the newspaper doing sending this damn hippie down here to interview me?
So a good start.
Right.
You're halfway home at that point.
But the thing I had done that surprised him is I had actually done the research.
That, by the way, makes all the difference. And when we show up, of course, as journalists, we're never that popular, clearly. But I have found if you're talking to Magic Johnson, you walk in there with his 5 books already read and post-it noted like that, and you say, oh, by the way, Mrs. Dart said to say hello. And he goes, Mrs. Dart. Mrs. Dart is Magic Johnson's third grade teacher. I met her husband on the golf course right out here, now closed, but now I'm like hops out there, I guess, across from the casino. And we played 18 holes together. I got all the Magic Johnson stories, so I called up to him to do a story and say, Mrs. Dart said to say hello. Really? He promised me 15 minutes and I got 3 hours.
Wow.
That's how you do it.
Because of Mrs. Dart. Yeah, that's a great story.
You have to start with something they don't expect. Now, this little hippie girl shows up and actually knows her stuff, has done her homework. So now things change. Walk us through that. This can be a fun story.
Well, we start talking about the dumping petition. I didn't quite understand what a...
So let's explain dumping.
Yeah, dumping is when another country sells a product in your market for less than it costs them, to put the materials together. And John Bassett knew that they were selling this one particular suit of furniture from Dalian, China. It's actually how the book begins. He's on this quest to figure out where this cheap $100 dresser is coming from. And he knew they were dumping it because he had had his factory workers deconstruct it and price out the parts piece by piece. And he knew that was less, that it cost more.
And the reason they do that is to grab market share. Once they knock everyone else out of business, then they can crank up the prices any way they want. This is John D. Rockefeller 100 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Read on.
Where was I?
So the dumping. He's taking over it. So you know your stuff. You're sitting down with him the first time.
Yeah, and not only that, but I know the story about his grandfather who started the business. So 1902, Civil War is just, you know, the family was cash poor and land rich after the Civil War, and what they did is they stole furniture making from you guys from Western New York and Michigan,
Grand Rapids,
and because they had cheap labor, eager, just like
in
the
Virginia.
Chinese did. Yeah, down in Virginia and North Carolina, and he basically employed former slaves, sharecroppers, people who were eager to join the brand new cash economy. And
he's one of the first to hire black employees.
He was, which sounds progressive, but he paid them half of what he paid the white workers. And and his competitors were worse. They were relegating them to sawmilling and sharecropping. So he captured the market share by doing that and became the largest furniture maker in America. In the 1960s, they were the largest furniture. Bassett Furniture was the largest furniture maker.
Millions of dollars.
Fortune 500 for a time. We were printing money, one manager told me.
No G in printing.
Right, exactly.
I like that. All right, so you're talking to him. At what point do you see his expression change from why am I talking to this hippie girl from Ohio and this woman actually knows her stuff?
Well, I knew about the family feud, so we'll get into that, but that's a great story. So in 1982, he finally gets so fed up with his evil older brother-in-law that they have a fist fight. And I knew all about that, because Joel told me. I mean, that wasn't hard. I just walked to my neighbor's house, and he told me that. So I waited until we were going to lunch that day. I set up 2 days of interviews, and I stayed in a little Holiday Inn or whatever in Galax, because it's about 2 hours away. And but we were going out to lunch. He goes to the lunch, the same diner every day. So we're going to the County Line Diner, and we're getting
into. What does he get? Same thing every day?
He was dieting then, so he was big on chef salad at the time. But I think it's different. Zach Galifianakis lives nearby and is sometimes in the same diner, which is just hilarious.
The
and
famous
apropos,
comedian, obviously,
nothing.
That's impossible. But
yeah, funny place, Galax, and. So as we're getting in his car, I finally say, hey, I hear about a fight in 1982 between you and your brother-in-law. I hear he elbowed you out. He goes, elbowed? Hell, it was more like a knee or a foot. And that was really, he said, but I'm not going to talk to you about that. I was glad I had that on tape. At least I had that.
It's kind of all you need, really.
Really. I mean, he just basically.
But the lead up to that point. This brother-in-law you like less and less page by page as he relegates our hero, John, to worse and worse jobs, puts him out to warehouses where he's supposed to fail, and then the guy succeeds.
Right, and he micromanages him like crazy. He tells him which airline to take when he's going on his trips. I mean, he was just awful to him at every turn.
And he keeps on succeeding anyway.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty cool story. So finally, it comes to blows, 82.
1982. And so the first time I went to Bassett, Virginia to interview for this, now I'm working on a book, I start talking to the line workers. And it's very much like a Downton Abbey kind of story.
Abbey in Virginia.
Yeah. Well, in that.
You guys all can figure that one out, right?
In that, in a company town where the family rules everything. I mean, they employed the police, the street sweeper. They owned the whole, you paid your light bill at Bassett Furniture. You paid your rent. It was deducted out of your thing. So the family controls everything. And like Downton Abbey, the people on the bottom, the servants, the line workers, they know all about the people at the top. The people at the top don't know much about them at all. So you can imagine, now the factories have all closed, I show up, they're dying to tell me about the people at the top. They're dying to tell me everything. So, I mean, it wasn't any great reporting techniques on my part, but I think I was there 5 minutes before somebody told me about the fist fight in 1982 that John got so, and here was what they said, and I had like 8 different people say, he got so fed up with Bob Spillman, and his nickname was SOB for sweet old Bob. His wife nicknamed him that. Well, if that tells you anything about it, he got...
Let's pause for a second. I have a wife. I don't know if you can spin that as praise, really. When your wife nicknames you SOB, think about what everyone else already thinks about you at that point. So.
Well, they got in this shoving thing, and it ended with John Bassett punching them out, and it was so bad that an ambulance driver had to be called. And what the line people told me was, the line workers said, and the whole town calls him Little John, then and now, even though he's 78. They said, and Little John tipped the ambulance driver $100 not to tell anyone it had happened, like something out of Dynasty. So.
Roanoke Dynasty, yes.
Right. No, Bassett.
Bassett,
much
sure, of course, yes, two hours away.
So I asked John Bassett about this fight. He goes, oh, it never happened, it never happened. You put that in your book, it will be wrong. It will cheapen your journalism.
It will cheapen your journalism.
And I said, but John, I've got 7-8 people telling me this story. I mean, a lot of people tell me this story. I said, and I've been to Starbucks with you. He doesn't carry a wallet. He carries his money, like with the money clip, and he pulls it out. And
like this?
Only it's full of $100 bills.
That is the difference, yes. Kids going to furniture.
So I thought, I said, John, that detail really rings true to me. I've seen you and your $100 bills. He said, no, I'm gonna. So it's this big, like, I said, well, he said, you can put it in, but say I said it didn't happen or whatever. And so my friend David and I were talking.
Which, by the way, in our business is as close a confession as you're going to get.
Exactly.
You can put it in, just say that I denied it. Okay.
Which was really, he didn't want to be seen as bad-mouthing his family, and that is true. He really didn't ever say anything bad about his family, even though they had insulted him and hurt him many times in the story.
They set him up for failure repeatedly, and he kept not failing, which screwed up their plans.
And he still craves their affection. He does.
It's amazing.
It's poignant. So I said to my friend, a journalist friend of mine, was reading Robert Caro's book at the time, the series about Lyndon Johnson, and I'm telling him this dilemma. I said, but I can't get it. And he goes, Mace, what would Robert Caro do in this situation? And we looked at each other. He would find the ambulance driver. So the next day, I called down to volunteer-run Bassett Rescue Squad, and I say, hi, I'm doing this book, it's partially set in Bassett, and I'm calling about a call that you would have made in December of 1982. And she went, uh-huh. Like, she gets that question all the time. And so I just kept going with it. I said, yeah, and it involved John Bassett and Bob Spillman.
Oh, we know,
honey. And she's like, uh-huh. And I said, you don't have any records on that, do you? She said, no, I wouldn't have any records. I said, you don't have anybody that might be around that made that call. And she said, well, we have Claude Cabler. He still runs calls on Friday. He's 86. So I was like, he still runs calls on Friday? At first I was like really happy he was alive. So I waited till Friday. She wouldn't give me his number, but I called him on Friday. And he basically confirmed the story. And then I said, wait a minute. Are you the one that got the $100? And he goes, I'm not going there.
Which, again, is as close as going to get to saying,
exactly.
I did take the $100.
Yeah.
That's, you can't make this stuff up, can you? It's good stuff.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up in the second half, more of John U. Bacon's conversation with Beth Macy.
This is the National Writers Series on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to John U. Bacon's conversation with Beth Macy.
While our hero, of course, John Bassett III, is making his way with his own company, splits off in 82 from the family company, restarts another part of the family business, he starts competing with his brother-in-law and beating him. Meanwhile, his another sort of, I guess, villain, not quite, but a modern villain, I guess, takes over Bob Spillman's company, the UNC B School Dean, and the phrase comes up, sawdust in your veins, those who have it and those who don't.
Right, as one of his critics said, he couldn't make a toothpick.
So the hotshot business dean from the hotshot business school at UNC, University of North Carolina, takes over what now is his competition, more or less. And he was not the same as John Bassett III.
He said, if those factories aren't making money, we're going to close them. And he did. I mean, it happened over about 10 years. But basically, at one point, the company had employed, I'm going to get the number wrong. I'm blanking on the numbers. But it had factories in like 20 different states. We're talking a major employer of multiple factories. 58 factories, I think, counting the little mattress factories.
Wow.
Yeah, a lot of factories. And one by one, he shut them all down.
It was just X's and O's. If it adds up, we keep them. If it doesn't,
and the shareholders. I mean, they're publicly, unlike John's company, I mean, to be fair, John runs Vaughn Bassett Furniture, which is privately held. He's picked the people on the board, and they respect him. And, he's sort of semi-retired, but he still runs it. But Bassett Furniture is a public company, and it has to answer to his shareholders.
So what happens next, of course, this guy takes over. The business school dean does not have sawdust in his veins, and of course John does. And John, being a hard-driving guy who works his tail off, the saving grace is that he cares deeply about the people who work for him. And they clearly knocked themselves out for him.
Right.
And that's what the business school dean clearly lacked.
Right, in order to file one of these anti-dumping petitions, you're petitioning the government to do an investigation to see if the country really is a dumping product.
It's hard to prove.
It's really hard to prove, and this is one of the things wrong with trade today, is that it's very, very expensive. Millions of dollars in legal fees. I mean, lots and lots of money. And by the time you're able to possibly file a petition, your business is really hurting. So most people don't have that kind of money. So I think the book argues that because of the way he was treated, because of the fist fight that he says wasn't important, because he has something to prove to those people back in Bassett who the real factory man is, I argue that he has this chip on his shoulder, and he's got skin in the game, and he really wants to show people how to make it in America, and he wants people to believe in this country again.
Mm-hmm. He's a hardcore patriot, no question. So the reaction from the people involved, from Bob Spielman, the guy I'm calling a villain, she's too nice for that. His son, of course, had a reaction. Of course, John Bassett III also had a reaction, and I can tell you from my own experience, whatever you think the reaction is going to be, you're going to be wrong. And whenever I write a book on Michigan football or Big Ten football, people always ask me, well, who's going to like it and who's going to be ticked off? And I said, I can make you two columns and at least three guys on both sides. This guy thinks he's going to like it and he's not for whatever reason. And this guy I think is going to never talk to me again and he's going to be cool. And I have no idea why. And you're never quite sure what it is that they're going to like about it or what's going to tick them off. It's very difficult to predict. This wasn't case the fact with Factory Man as well.
Yeah. So we sent him a copy. It had been edited. It was about to go to Galley.
We sent it to John Bassett.
We sent him a copy for fact-checking purposes only. He got it on, Tuesday, and he started calling me up. I was really worried about the race chapter, actually. That was the one that was keeping me up at night. And we can talk more about that later if you want. But so he would call me every couple of chapters, and then he'd say, well, page 27, really, that was a different year. And he had kind of good factual corrections. And then he didn't call for like 3 days. And he called and he said, I want you to come up to my house on Saturday and bring Tom. That's my husband. That's an odd thing. I don't need to bring Tom. And anyways, well, then it was
apparently
snowing.
Apparently you do.
Then it was snowing on Saturday, and I'm kind of a weenie. He lives up in the mountains, so I said, Tom, will you come with me? Because I wanted him to drive. I'm not a terrible driver in the snow. I wouldn't do very well here. And so we go up, and he's got a list of his facts that are wrong. It's about four pages, single space, that his assistant Sheila has typed up. Mm-hmm. And his face gets redder the more and more that we go on. And by the end, it's really clear that he's upset with me. He thinks I've been snarky about his wealth, which, fair point, probably I was in a few spots. Mm-hmm. And he said later that I had brought up a lot of hurts and that he thought he was recovered from, but that the book brought up a lot of stuff. And he took it out on me that day. And we really had a come to Jesus like I've never had with anyone. And tears were shed, screaming was done. I think there was some snot coming out of my nose at one point. So then I said, I got to get away from you for a while. I was really mad at him because of the way he treated me. Mm-hmm. And I said, I thought I'd written up basically a loving but complicated portrait of somebody who I thought cared about 700 factory jobs, but it turns out you really cared about something else, your billionaire friends. And so I said, I'm going to take a break for a while, because he calls all the time, right? I said, don't call me. And
it's an old trick you learned from Harriet, right?
He said, okay. And then he started calling, and I'm not answering the phone. And then I was working at the newspaper at the time, because I was back at the newspaper while my book was being edited, and he sent flowers to the newspaper. Yellow roses, big spread, really nice. I left them there. I didn't want them. I just left them in the newsroom. I was really mad at him. And then he called, and he sincerely apologized. I mean, like, I answered, like, by Wednesday or something. He sincerely apologized. But, you know, you never know when you're writing for some... I mean, I didn't have anything wrong other than those few facts. I didn't have to change anything. Mm-hmm. And so you never know what's in somebody's heart. You don't know if he knows I don't have to change this one particular thing that was in his crawl, or if he really was sorry. But then in the same conversation, he also asked me to speak at his funeral. So
I have to tell you, I've written 8 books. Not one subject has ever asked me to speak at their funeral. Funerals have come up, not in that context. That's very impressive, especially when you're clearly, going to the outer edges with these people of their comfort zone, and they don't like all the stuff you've written. It's uncomfortable. It's difficult to hear sometimes. And yet, if you still have their clearly profound respect, that's a pretty amazing accomplishment, I would say, for this business especially. When you show up and they already don't like us.
We've had all the emotions. We really have. We've really been high on each other. We've really hated each other. So.
Honestly earned, I guess, in that case. But there you go. The cool part, you're there hanging out at home. Walk us through the tweet from a certain actor.
Oh, so I was actually at the local NPR affiliate getting ready to go on the Tavis Smiley Show. The book had been out maybe 2 weeks. And a friend of mine texts, he said, holy crap, have you seen what Tom Hanks wrote on Twitter? And I said, no, I wasn't very Twitter savvy at the time. So I said, read it to me. And I could pretend that I don't have this memorized. But we're friends, so I'll just be honest and say that Tom Hanks wrote something like, Factory Man is great summer reading. I give it 42 stars. No, 142 stars. It's that good. So that was really nice. I mean, he has like 7 million followers. He probably has more than that now. But so
hey, by the way, he just made you a bestseller.
No, it actually already was a bestseller.
There you go.
Actually, it already was.
Goes a long way these days.
He made it stay on longer than it would have, I'm sure.
And both books now have, I know you're limited here in what you can say, have Hollywood interest.
Yeah. They're both in development. So Tom Hanks's company optioned Factory Man, and True Vine has been optioned as well. So that's pretty exciting. Thank you.
Before I turn it over to Q&A, though, one more question. So that is how the guy I consider the hero of the book, of course, John Bassett III, responded both to the earlier draft as well as to the later copy. He clearly ultimately came around on the book, generally, I would say.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I called him the day that the movie deal got, like, cemented, because he knew we were maybe going to, it was maybe in the works. And I called him, told him about it, and he said, just remember, the higher the monkey climbs up the tree, the more it shows its ass. Like, he's got a million of them.
This is a guy we journalists want to talk to, by the way. Yeah. There are certain times, usually when we talk to people, and I'm sure the same way, 90% of what you hear, you know, is not going to go in the book. I mean, you need to know it, you need the background, you know what's going on. But once in a while, you hear something, you go, oh, hell yeah.
Yeah.
That, I don't know where it goes exactly, but that I know goes in the book. And you hear that line, you go, oh, yeah, that's final copy right there. If I was smarter, I'd end right there, but I'm not. So the quote-unquote villain, as I call him, not you, the SOB, his son. You run into his son at the airport, was it, or the train station?
It was at the train station. It was an event about just last spring. It was a garden club event, and they asked me to come down to do a signing. And, of course, I love to help Bassett, Virginia. It's still really struggling, and anything I can do, I'm happy to do it. And so I hadn't seen Bob Spillman. His son, Bob, has passed away. His son, Rob, is now the CEO of the company. And I hadn't seen him since the book came out, although I had been told that he had been telling people it was a very good book of fiction. So.
Which, by the way, is the worst insult you can give either one of us.
Yeah.
You can say your book stinks, that's fine. Calling it fiction, that one hurts.
And but he never asked for a correction or anything like that. Anyway, so I finally ran into him at this thing at the train depot, and he couldn't have been nicer. It was very startling because I hadn't seen him in a couple years, and he was smiling, and he has these beautiful blue eyes and kind of twinkly, and shaking my hand, how you doing? Congrats on the success of your book. And then he looked at me, and this is a very Southern thing, you just have to know this, he said, with this big smile, of course, I'll never get over how you treated my father.
And then, bless you. Bless her soul.
And so I just pointed out, I said, I hear you on that. I said, you might recall that I actually came back a third time to interview you because I had written the book and I'd sent it out to readers, like people who knew a lot about furniture or business. You always want to have, if you're weak in one area, like I wasn't a business reporter, I wanted to have business professors read the book just to make sure I didn't miss some really important thing about economics. But one of my early readers of the draft had said, I think you're too hating on Bob Spillman. And so I called Rob and I said, can I come back? I need more to bring him alive as a human. And I got a few details from him. So I reminded Rob when he said, I'll never get over how you treated my father. I said, Rob, the worst stuff in the book came from you when I went back to do that third interview. So it was stories like, well, my favorite story, and it is funny. Bob Spillman was such a micromanager and he had this plant manager who lived in Atlanta, and he would want to leave early every Friday at 3:30 to go home and see his wife. Well, Bob Spillman hated that he wouldn't live in Bassett. You were supposed to live in Bassett. And he didn't like anybody leaving early, even though he had already worked his 40 hours. So he made it, the CEO of Fortune 500 company, made it his personal mission to figure out where Dick Rosenberg was on Friday afternoon. So every Friday he would call down and see if he had left early. And so one Friday he calls down and he said, where the hell's Rosenberg? And the secretary says, well, he already left. So okay, he hangs up. He calls the Virginia State Highway Patrol and has them set up a roadblock on the North Carolina border. Which he totally knew. He had a big function for him every summer, like a big picnic for the Highway Patrol people. They used to drive him to furniture market, escorted him. And so, I mean, he had a lot of tentacles.
Down, right?
And so finally, Rosenberg comes back. It's exactly 5 o'clock. Spillman's greeting him there in the Bassett foyer, and he says, "It's 5 o'clock. Have a good weekend." So that's, I mean, that's the story I got when I said, what can you tell me that makes me make your dad a fooler in the round picture? So, but I get it. I mean, it would have been tough, you know.
But when Tom Hanks has 142 stars, I would probably get over it. So we've got time for some Q&A here. Let's turn the lights on and start asking the lovely Beth Macy some questions. Sir.
I'm wondering whether in researching the book on the boys in the circus, if you delved at all into the psychology of what it is it that creates a huge audience for things like sideshows. Obviously, mm-hmm. there wouldn't be a sideshow if there weren't an awful lot of us, who want to go to a fair or something and see it. I remember when I was young, taking my girlfriend, now wife's little brothers, to the Michigan State Fair in Detroit, and there was a sideshow, a freak show they called it, and I'll never forget the Jamaican spider lady, you know, and when I came home with the boys, the family really excoriated me for taking them to a sideshow. I mean, I thought it was a very fascinating place, and it was packed with people. We wonder, what is it about us that we want to patronize something like that?
Thank goodness we really don't anymore. The sideshows kind of went away with the rise in disability rights, right? So, you know, they kind of went away in the 70s and 80s. And when they first started, Barnum was the one that made sideshows big in the 1860s and 70s. It was, you know, the word science was brand new. There was this fascination with Africa. And there was this idea that, I mean, it was all just to get another quarter out of your pocket, really. It was this ding. But there was this idea that if you go to the sideshow, it's this educational, scientific pursuit. And so that's the way it was spun. I mean, why you would go see it, I mean, maybe you want to just be part of this in thing. Maybe you wanted to feel good about yourself. I had a really hard time with that. There was a show on at the time I was working on the book called American Horror Story. Has anybody seen that? And my son, Max, loves that show. Well, I watched like 40 minutes of it and I had to turn it off. It was really upsetting. And I said, Max, you lost me during the orgy, the freak orgy, you lost me. And we're texting, he's in college. He goes, Mom, freaks need love too. But I don't get that, and I've been dinged about it. A couple reviewers have said you should have written more about the sideshow and the psychology and the importance of it in the history of entertainment. But the part of the book that is my jam is the racial part, and so that is what I've witnessed where I live. We have a still very, very small black middle class, a lot of people struggling in poverty, and that's been my job to sort of explain that. And so the chance for me to go back in history and to try to kind of write about why we have these problems today and what came before, that was the part that really lit me up. So I try to do my best, but the pictures especially at the beginning were really hard to look at. And then I got sort of used to it, like you do. But it is an interesting history. It's part of our history that doesn't get talked about very much anymore. And boy, are there people who know a lot about the sideshow. The great thing about being a reporter is if you don't know something, you can always call somebody. Like one of the earliest picture of them with their little suits on when they look real scared. I sent that to a historic a theater professor in Charleston, South Carolina, who saw all kinds of things that I didn't see in it. He blew it up and he said, I think they've been wearing these suits. He knew what kind of suits they were, how much it cost approximately. And he said, I think they've been wearing them for 2 years. And he had his take on what the suits showed about the life that they were living. And so that was great for me. I mean, that was great to be able to call them up. And I said, oh, thank you so much. He goes, no, thank you. Historic menswear is my passion. So that was great. Like that's just
something
a reporter
something we all
thing.
Share, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. But like the sideshow people, oh my God, the sideshow people. There are a lot of people who collect stuff about sideshows. And they're really helpful. I mean, a lot of them gave me the pictures to use in the book and gave me their take. I mean, a couple have written books. My favorite one is this former carny from Canada named Al Stencil. He's quoted throughout the book. But he ran off with the circus in the 60s, and his mother said, oh my God, he's left for the circus. And his dad said, he'll be back. And he didn't come back. He ends up buying a carnival himself and has his own sideshow. And so he's totally into it. And he came to my book launch party from Canada in this old brown van that I probably wouldn't have driven to the other side of the town. And he slept in the van on the way. Like, it was like he was still traveling with
he's
the sideshow.
Carny,
yeah, but there are people who specialize. They really, the sideshow experts specialize in things. Like, there's one guy in Ireland who collects data and pictures and objects relating to Irish giants. He specializes in the souvenir rings of Irish giants. I mean, like, that's specialty. And but that was really, I mean, that was a fun part, just to find these like kind of hidden alcoves of people. Like, there's a guy in Baltimore who's got, I think he said 300,000 pieces of memorabilia. And some of the pictures came from him. He was so excited when he heard I was writing a book. He said, oh, I love albinos. He said, the other day I was walking and I saw one and I decided to follow him just to see if people stared at them still. People are funny.
If people weren't funny, we'd be out of business, so.
Exactly.
On that note, a hearty thank you for, of course, Doug and Ann Stanton.
Yeah.
Thank you both. Thank you for being here, and please join us in the lobby where you'll be signing books, and both John and Beth will answer more questions. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
That was Beth Macy talking with John U. Bacon. Beth Macy's latest book is True Vine, Two Brothers, a Kidnapping, and a Mother's Quest, a true story of the Jim Crow South. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org, and listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Milcarrick.